This is an ABC podcast.
If a four-year-old has a screaming, shouting, end-of-the-world tantrum because she can't ride a unicorn, you could tell her to stop being so silly. You could try manufacturing a unicorn with a Shetland pony and a toilet roll. Or you could do as Philippa Perry suggests and say something like, "Darling, you poor thing. You really want a unicorn to ride, don't you? I'm so sorry that you can't." Philippa is a psychotherapist, and she's written a best-selling book about parenting called The Book You Wish Your Parents Had Read. And Philippa says that acknowledging feelings, even the impossible ones and the painful, nasty ones, is key to all our relationships with children, but also with our partners, our friends, and actually with ourselves. For nearly three decades, Philippa has been married to the Turner-winning artist Grayson Perry. The two make a very striking couple, Philippa with her black and white bob and funky glasses, and Grayson, who's been cross-dressing since he was a teenager and is often fabulously attired in a frock, makeup, and wig. Hi, Philippa.
Hello.
Philippa, as well as your book on parenting, you've written a graphic novel about being a psychotherapist. It's illustrated by your daughter, Flo. What do you think about the way that she's drawn you?
It was so great to see the whole book reimagined through her eyes. And I loved it because she brought her view of the world into the book. I didn't actually have much to do with her interpretation. I left her to it pretty much. And I really like what she's done with the place. Love it.
So when you're drawn wearing open-toed sandals to meet a client, is this true or was this true, Philippa?
I used to work as a psychotherapist from home, and I was all for the comfy Birkenstock, I must say. Yes, it was probably not a very professional way to dress. And this is what psychotherapists tend to do. They tend to get a little bit comfy. So you're all nervous and you go and see a psychotherapist and you think, oh my God, socks and sandals or something. You know?
How can I trust this person with my mental health?
I just wanted to sort of highlight how unaware we therapists can be from time to time about the impression we might be creating.
The client in the story is called James, and he says in the second session, "I suppose you're going to ask me about my childhood." Why are childhoods so interesting to therapists?
Well, in our childhoods, we form our sort of unspoken beliefs. We get the blueprint for our relationship with the world. If you were to finish the sentence, "other people are," whatever word you put there without thinking, that was probably formed in your babyhood. Other people are lovely. Other people are untrustworthy. Other people are not on my side. Whatever you come up with was probably formed in your childhood. And we form belief systems and ways of reacting and responding to the world unconsciously in childhood. And what worked for us in childhood might work against us in adulthood. And what psychotherapists are quite good at, despite their sandals, is picking out what you're doing that isn't working for you anymore, but validating why you did it so you don't feel a fool.
Well, then let me ask you a little bit about your childhood, Philippa. People are what?
Well, I just, you know, when you went, "people are," to throw my question back at me, I just went, I felt constipated with it, which is quite interesting because in my childhood, I didn't really have a clue about anything. I wasn't sure of anything. I'd sense one thing and get told another. I didn't really have much faith in my instincts. So that's probably why when you go, "other people are," and you throw my work back at me like that, I freeze. Like, I don't know. I don't know.
Whereabouts did you grow up?
I grew up in the north of England between Manchester and Liverpool in a town called Warrington, which was sort of gritty, industrious, and not at all glamorous.
Were you a happy child, Philippa?
I expect for some of the time I might have been, yes. I was certainly a well-looked-after child in terms of material things. I never went hungry. I always had somewhere nice and warm to sleep. If I cut my knee, I'm sure I got a plaster and a kiss. Also, I might have been told not to make a fuss as well.
Well, that sounds pretty good on balance, doesn't it? What's missing there?
It's pretty good. It is. It's pretty good. But my parents made the fatal mistake, of course, it's not a fatal mistake. It's a mistake we all make. And it seems not to be a mistake at all, which is they want their children to be happy all the time, which sounds fantastic. Who wouldn't want their child to be happy all the time? But the trouble is with that, is that if you are angry as a child or sad and you aren't accepted when you're sad and you're not accepted when you're angry, you feel like you're bad for feeling these things. So you learn, you adapt and you learn that you're not nice when you're sad. You're not nice when you're angry. These feelings are pushed down. And you get a sort of feeling of, I must be a bad person. And so I say to parents, you know, allow your child to be sad. Allow your child to be angry and help them find acceptable ways of expressing that. You're not going to change that. But if you say to someone, don't be angry, if I say to you, you know, don't be angry,
I'm furious. I'm really furious at you.
Come back at me twice, aren't you, with that?
Do you ever remember yourself as a kid sort of confessing to your parents that you were less than seamlessly happy and how they responded? Like, well, how would that have been dealt with in the moment?
Well, I knew not to tell my parents that I wasn't happy. I'd learned that wasn't a great thing to do. But once I was at a party, one of my parents' parties, I was supposed to be like 12, I was handing around the Twiglets. Do you have Twiglets in Australia? It's a Marmite-y, sticky thing. Yes, it's disgusting. Vegemite-y sort of cheese straw. Anyway, yeah. Anyway, handing around the Vegemite-y cheese straws, which are called Twiglets. And this gentleman said to me, are you having a happy childhood? I dare say he was one cocktail in when he asked me that. You know, how do you talk to children? He obviously didn't know. Are you having a happy childhood? And I thought, and I said, no, not particularly. And my father overheard this and he was absolutely furious. He went, of course you have a happy childhood. Don't talk nonsense. And, you know, I thought, oh dear, I've got something wrong again. You know, because you're always told to tell the truth. And then, oh, it's not acceptable. You know, it's all very confusing.
What could he have said instead?
Well, he could have done, maybe after his guests have gone, have said, tell me more about this not feeling happy at the moment or something. And I would have said something like, I really hate going to school. And he would have said something like, oh, I hated going to school too. And instead of having a moment of correction, which is what we had, we could have had a moment of connection. So it'd be a great idea if instead of seeing our children's sort of negative moods as something to correct, we saw them as an opportunity to connect with them. And so that's what could have happened. I mean, I do see it from his point of view as well. He'd fought a world war and here were we living in peacetime. He must have thought, my God, we haven't got bombs dropping and she's still not happy. But, you know, there you go. I can see it from his point of view now. But I at the time, you know, I was a child and I couldn't have that meta perspective. This is what I urge parents to do. Just to see, though, if you have an urge to correct your child, just hold that back for a moment and think, can I find out a bit more and connect instead? So instead of, you know, when you get, I don't like school, well, you have to go. Sort of, I don't like school. Tell me more about that. What do you think you can do about that? How do you think you could solve that? Sort of open it up rather than close it down. When the kid seems to be veering towards unhappiness or anger, open it up.
And what do you think stops parents from doing that? I mean, just as you're talking, I'm imagining that you might think part of your job as a parent is to do that correction. Part of a job might be to fact check. If a child's having an emotion, say they want something that you know is impossible, or they're complaining about something that's unreasonable, isn't part of the job of the parent to show them where they're making a mistake, steer them somewhere different emotionally?
The job of the parent, the main job of the parent, is to have a really good relationship with the child, so that the child feels they can tell the parent absolutely anything without being told, don't be silly. I mean, fancy if you went to see a psychotherapist and you said, I feel miserable, but there's no reason for it. And she said, don't be silly. I mean, that would be a waste of 60 quid, wouldn't it? So, you know, when the child says something that is obviously untrue. So if I say something like, I'm scared to go to sleep because there are monsters under the bed. Okay. It's very tempting to say there are no monsters under the bed. That's your sense of reality. Your kid's got a different sense of reality. And so what I think is a better thing to say is, tell me more about these monsters. What are their names? Because monsters under the bed are, you know, a frequent thing that children complain about. They are a go-to metaphor for not feeling quite right, for feeling a bit scared, for feeling a bit anxious. And if we tell someone not to be anxious, it kind of doesn't work.
I guess another fear parents might have is that if you acknowledge a child's feeling, you're kind of one step away from acquiescing, going along with what they want. Is it possible to empathise without agreeing?
Yes. Of course it is. You know, I can remember I used to take my daughter swimming quite a lot. She loves swimming. And then we go to the zoo and the penguins are in something that looks like a swimming pool. She goes, can I go swimming with the penguins? No, you can't. It's such a shame you can't go swimming with the penguins. You poor thing, you want to go swimming with the penguins and you can't. It looks so much fun in there with them, doesn't it? Yes, it does. It really does. Yes, I know. It's just very unfortunate that we can't go swimming with them. The tears soon dry up. But if you go, don't be stupid. Of course you can't go swimming with the penguins. No one's allowed to go swimming with the penguins. It's just not allowed. What you're doing is you're fighting their feeling. Of course you can't go swimming with the penguins. Kids have tantrums because they can't fly to the moon. Don't argue with them about not being able to fly to the moon or have a very expensive toy that would fill up your entire flat. Don't argue with them about that. Just go, I'm sorry, I can see you're really upset that we can't have it. Don't disagree with what your kid is feeling. Because when you go, no, you can't swim with the penguins, it's like you're disagreeing. So, you know, I don't expect you have many icy roads in Australia, but over here we do. And if you get into a skid in the car, what you do is you steer into the skid so you can steer out of it. But if you just lock your wheels in the other direction, the car will still go in the direction of the skid. So you turn the wheels into the direction of the skid so you can steer out. So there's the driving lesson. It's the same with the feelings. I'm sorry you can't swim with the penguins. Tell me about the monsters under the bed. You want to fly to the moon, and yet here am I apparently stopping you. How frustrating. Or you want to have chocolate instead of cabbage for lunch. I'm sorry. You know, whatever it is. And I say to parents, I'm not about indulging children. I think for the sake of your relationship together, it's really important that you do put down boundaries. And you put that boundary down before you reach your limit, because we want to be on the same side as the kid.
I want to return to your own Twiglet handing around childhood, Philippa. What kind of education did you get?
Education was an absolute disaster. I was an undiagnosed dyslexic. I don't even know if we diagnosed dyslexia in the 60s and 70s. And so I wasn't very good at schoolwork, so I was sort of written off and nobody had any expectations for me. And I'd be quite sort of chirpy and intelligent in class, but my written work would be sort of written in the wrong page of the book. It'd be all blots. Most of the letters would be backwards. And so I'd just get fail, fail, fail for everything. So they thought I was thick. And I left school at 15.
But you were at boarding school. as part of that schooling? And why were you sent to boarding school? Was that a common thing in the place you grew up, or what was going on?
My parents were sort of middle class. They probably liked to think they were upper middle class. And we lived in, grand isolation in a house in the middle of the countryside, but near towns that were working class. And so if I was to go to a day school, there'd be working class children there. And my parents, in their wisdom, thought I shouldn't mix with them because it would pollute my mind and I might get the wrong idea about what society is. I think they were mistaken in their beliefs. I think they were snobs.
Were you lonely at boarding school?
I was lonely at home because my sister didn't like me. I wanted to slip in there. Oh, you can't really blame her, but luckily I've had 20 years of therapy. So I still think you can't really blame her because of the way that us siblings were sort of pitched against each other. But that's another story. So I went to boarding school. I wasn't lonely at boarding school particularly, but, you know, I did miss my parents and I did miss home, and I was sad to go there, yeah.
So that part of your education finished when you were 15. What happened next?
Well, interestingly, actually, they thought, I'm afraid she won't get any O-levels, which was the sort of the exams you had to sort of do before you could leave school. She won't get any, I'm afraid. And actually, I got 9 because I think the examination board had decided not to mark down spelling. If you could understand what the kid was saying and not mark down spelling. So I actually got 9 and they were a bit shocked. But the plan had already been made for me to go and be finished off at this Swiss finishing school where I learned to ski, speak French and make choux pastry. And I can also talk like this if necessary because everybody talked like this at that school.
Was it like going onto another planet? What was it like day to day to arrive in that world?
Absolutely like going onto another planet because, you know, whatever background you come from, there are sort of scripts. There's sort of like modes of culture, modes of being together that you sort of take for granted and you think they're just normal. Like if you see two Japanese people meet, they do this sort of bow and they exchange their business cards with their thumbs on the top of it. And for them, that's like normal. Like nobody taught them to do that. They just do it, right? So I went to this Swiss finishing school and I said, pardon, which was very, very common and made them laugh. Apparently you should say, what did you say? Not pardon, because that was lower class. And you have to go, you have to call the thing you wear to stop food falling on your lap. You have to call that a napkin and not a serviette. And I didn't have the language. Of course, I had it by about week 3, but, you know.
And so did you like adopt that language and even that accent while you were there and then toss it off again? Or did you stay you in the midst of all of that poshness?
I think wherever I am, I'm a bit of a chameleon. I think I adapted a bit. I might have held on to, you know, a little bit of my northern accent as a sort of quaint affectation. I'm not sure. I can't remember. But I do remember that we were supposed to speak French the whole time and we invented a language between French and English that the Swiss teachers could not understand. So, for instance, of course in French is d'accord. And we go, Daki, Dax. So it was a bit sort of between upper class English and French. It was a whole new franglais.
And what do you think your parents wanted you to do after that? What was meant to be the culmination of this?
They wanted me to meet, you know, the daughters of a lord or a lady and probably marry very, very well. Marry somebody with a stately home so they could live in the lodge at the end of the drive, I think. I'm not sure. I mean, they did say that once and it was a joke, of course. But, you know, as Freud said, there's no such thing as a joke.
So what happened after you'd finished being finished at your Swiss finishing school?
It was an absolute disaster. I pleaded, please can I go and do my A-levels, which is the next exams up, at the local technical college. And they went, oh, no, you'd meet common people there and then you'd marry the wrong person. You can't possibly do that. So I was sent to secretarial college, which for a dyslexic person was an absolute disaster. But I did learn to touch type. And then when the internet came along about 20 years later, I could type faster than anyone else, which was marvellous. So I got a job as a secretary in a firm of solicitors, and it was no spell check or even electric typewriters then. And they sort of kind of realised that spelling wasn't really my thing, but they liked me and they made me a clerk, which was really nice of them, and gave me my own typist. And I had to collect small debts through the lower courts, the county court.
And what did that entail?
Well, it was all these people. We had one big client, the co-op, if it was in those days, who used to sell people white goods on hire purchase. And, you know, when they couldn't keep up the payments, I had to collect the money through the county court. And, of course, they were always absconding from their addresses. So we had to hire somebody called an inquiry agent, or in modern parlance, a private detective, to hunt down these people. There used to be ex-policemen that used to do this work, and they used to go in with their big boots, plod, plod. Is so-and-so here? No. Where have they gone? Don't know. And they'd plod, plod off again. And then the idea was then you write off the debt and close the file. But I thought this wasn't very efficient. So after work, instead of employing the plod, plod ex-policeman, I went round and I go, "Hi, is Joe about?" "Oh, that's right. He went back to live with his mum. Oh, just remind me of her address, will you?" "Of course it is. Thanks a lot, love." I'd find Joe and I go, Joe, the hire purchase agreement for the stereo unit. What can you pay?" And Joe would be really, usually, very, very nice. And he'd go, "Pound a week?" I said, "That sounds a lot. How about 50p? And he'd think I was lovely because I sort of wasn't being heavy-handed like Mr. Plod was. So I got back so much more money not going through the county court, but actually just collecting debts, really, and being nice to people.
You were clearly good at it, Philippa, but this must have been exactly the kind of world your parents wanted you to have nothing to do with.
Oh, it was fabulous. I was meeting these people at last. I set up my own business as an inquiry agent, and I'd made friends with all the other solicitors at the county court, so they all gave me their business. So I had quite a good business. But, and I did it for about 3 years, and then I was getting bored, actually. And so I sold the business and went to London, and I just got a job, because I've never actually been very ambitious about work or anything. Maybe it was because I was told I was thick and my schooling wasn't good. So I just got a job, and I got a job in McDonald's. And it was just opening at the time. I thought it was a rather exciting business model, actually. And I got promoted, probably above my ability, but I was a manager after about 3 months of a unit of the Oxford Circus branch in the middle of London that was turning over about 1 or 2 million a year, and I was the manager, and I just loved the people working in that branch. And a lot of people go on gap years to find out about other cultures, and they go to Thailand and stuff. Working in McDonald's was my gap year. I met all those people my mother never wanted me to meet. And I found out how clever they were. And I just thought, why? I know why I'm here. It's because I don't care much about work and I never did any A levels. But why are you here? You're really bright. And I found out about racism and how black people at that time, they were never thought by their teachers that they were going to amount to anything. And so they just got a McJob. And I just thought, what am I doing actually? So we all went to night school and got A levels. Because in those days, it's very difficult now, but in those days there were government subsidized adult education classes. So you could go and do A levels. And I started to collect A-levels. It was great fun.
So you started doing A-levels, doing study outside of the work that you were doing. When did psychotherapy first come on the scene for you?
Well, psychology was one of the very first A-levels I did, and I got fascinated by the subject, and I just kept reading and reading and reading about it. I've never stopped reading about it. So I started reading about it then. And I did other jobs because the hamburger, the smell after a while, and it was quite a responsible job, and it wasn't very well paid then. I can't say what it is now. And so I went to work for a firm of accountants. I was an IT manager because I learned quite a lot about computers at McDonald's. And I was an IT manager at a big firm of accountants, one of those massive city firms. And I think I might have invented the phrase, have you turned it off and on again?
The whole world owes you a debt, Philippa Perry.
I know. But I was the person that read the manual and they called me the IT manager. It was amazing. There were massive computers with great big tapes in them. And while I was working there, the floppy disk was invented. And that was amazing. It transformed my life.
This is Conversations with Sarah Konoski.
So, Philippa, you'd gone to Swiss finishing school, managed a McDonald's in the middle of London, and worked as a remittance clerk. How did you get your start in psychotherapy?
Oh, I volunteered for the Samaritans, which was like a step to becoming a psychotherapist, really. At the time, I thought it was to give something back to society, you know. But after a while, I realised that I went there to find out whether it was safe to explore feelings. The Samaritans is a sort of suicide helpline in Britain. And I went there to see whether it was safe to explore feelings. So I got the training and they put me on the phones and I listened to people as they explored their feelings. And I found out that not only was it safe, it was beneficial. Now, of course, I'd read all that, but I just sort of didn't believe it because I'd been brought up to believe, you know, down with those negative feelings, keep them in the box, don't let them out. Goodness knows what would happen if you let them out. So, you know, don't let yourself lose your temper or feel your sadness because it might never stop. And I sort of took this on board so deeply that all the reading about psychology and psychotherapy hadn't undone it. So I think I went there to see whether it was safe to explore feelings. And I found out that it was more than safe. It was the most fantastic thing you could do for yourself. And then I went into therapy. Then I dared to go to therapy after I acted as a sort of therapist for 4 years for other people.
Who did you meet on a creative writing course, Philippa, in this stage of your life in 1987?
You see, I could not stop doing the evening classes. They had become a habit. They were a great place to meet people. And I thought it was about time I explored my creative side. So apart from art school, I also went to creative writing classes. And there was a nice bunch of people there. And there was a very uncouth bloke in a red leather jacket who had an awful Essex accent. He talked like this. And I thought, oh, he's the last person I'm going out for a drink with. Well, that was my future husband, Grayson Perry, who has adapted. And we both talk with a very similar accent now. So we've both rubbed off on each other.
So if your first impressions weren't so great, how did that change? How did you start to get a different view of him?
Well, we had to read out our diaries in the class, keep a diary to read out in class. And ours were the funniest. So we sort of bonded over that.
Do you remember what he wrote about?
Yeah, he wrote about having to dog sit for someone and stay their flat and how the dog would go on walks and sniff out condoms and tampons wherever they were. You could be in the nicest park and it would dive under a bush, find these disgusting things. And he wrote about it in a very funny way. And I wrote about, I met this bloke at art school and we started having sex. And this guy said to me, the second time we had it off, he said, oh, sorry, it's always quick the first time. And I said, that was the second time. Thanks, I feel so special that you remembered. So that was my diary.
When you and Grayson went on your first date, what were the two options?
He said, do you want to go to an exhibition opening private view or would you like to go to a transvestite club? Well, I'd just come back from being in New York with one of my old legal friends, and we'd gone to a lot of these drag clubs where you stand on tables and lip sync with all the makeup on. And I thought, this is fun. Let's do that. Let's go to transvestite club. So I put on a long blonde wig, a feather boa, all the face makeup, false eyelashes, heels, clinging, fitted pink dress. I don't think Grayson had ever seen me with makeup on before. Anyway, I went to his house and I knocked on the door, and I'd not been there before. And his mother answered the door. I thought, he lives with his mother. I thought this guy was quite hip and he's living with his mother. And I asked for Grayson, and then he replied in his voice, "Who wants him?" I thought, "It's you." And he looked at me and went, "It's you." We neither of us recognised ourselves because we were dressed up as women.
But Grayson's drag was a middle-aged housewife, a frumpy housewife.
Yeah, it was.
How did
and
you
this
feel
transvestite
about that?
Thing was not like a drag club. It was like men in women's clothes talking about dumper trucks and motorbikes. And they were wearing the dowdiest women's clothes. It wasn't the same as drag. I had a very fast education. Degrees of cross-dressing, and that was the sort of cross-dressing he was into at the time.
Did you ever find it uncomfortable or strange or wish that he didn't?
No. No, I didn't, actually. No. People ask me this and they don't believe me, but I really didn't. And nor did I find it awkward or strange once we had a child, because that was like he never pretended that he didn't do it. I think what makes things awkward and strange is when you're a little bit creepy about it, or you're ashamed of it, or you want to be humiliated or something. And that's when people sort of act weird when they're dressed up. He doesn't act weird. He's just himself. So it's great.
Was there something sexy about that? The fact that he was so confident in who he was and what he liked that he just embraced it?
I think confidence is sexy, yes. Too much confidence, no.
Well, what about when you and Grayson had Flo? Did you have to have a conversation with her? Like, okay, so Dad sometimes looks different from the other dads.
We never have the conversation about anything. We have lots of talking all the time. And so when people ask me, how do I have the conversation about sex and consent with my daughter, I just say, keep talking. Keep talking from 0 to 100. Just keep talking. Once when we were out and she's a confident person. She was circulating on her own. And she was approached by a tabloid journalist who said to her, what's it like having a transvestite for a dad? She was 10. And she said back to him, I don't know. I've never had any other sort of dad, so I don't know what's different. And I just thought, yeah, and it's so long since I've had any other sort of husband that I'm the same, really. It just seems everything's normal to me.
Did you and Grayson, when you had a child together, have to think about how you wanted to raise her and if you were going to try to do it differently from the way that you'd been raised? Was that something you consciously approached together even before you had Flo?
Yeah, this was absolutely huge. Because we both looked at how we were brought up and we thought, what didn't work for you? And, you know, I was working at the Samaritans, volunteering at the Samaritans at this time as well. So I did know that it was really important that people were accepted where they were. I'd learned that. So I never wanted her not to feel not acceptable. So it's this thing of going with the feeling rather than going against it wasn't difficult at all. It's made her very confident.
Did your parents notice that you were trying to do something different in the way you were raising your child?
It was quite interesting. I was round there with my daughter once and, you know, they grow so fast. And she stood up underneath the piano, which she'd done the week before with impunity, but of course she'd grown an inch since the week before. She hit her head on the top of the piano And of course she screamed and she was crying. So I was going, oh, that hurt, didn't it? You know, and doing the cuddling and the rocking and stuff. My father said, what are you doing? What are you doing? If you comfort a child like that, she'll be crying the whole time. You must ignore them when they cry. And I thought, that explains a lot of how I feel when I'm sad. That explains why I feel I have to apologize to anyone if I'm feeling sad. Wow. And I went, thanks for your opinion, Dad. I think we'll carry on with the comforting.
It sounds like right from the very early days you had a sense of how you wanted to parent her. Did you ever have moments, though, Philippa, of thinking, cripes, I hope this new experiment is the right way to go? Because it is so different.
That's what I thought at the beginning. I thought, well, see how it works, shall we, this experiment of being nice, on being on the same side as your child, of not having one of you right and one of you wrong, by me defining myself in I statements rather than defining her. So when I wanted to leave the playground, I didn't go, it's time to leave the playground. It's time for your lunch now. I'd go, I'm cold, I'm tired, 2 minutes more and then we're going. I just told the truth. All the other parents are going, come on now, it's time for your lunch. They go, I don't want my lunch. But there's no arguing with me when I go, I'm cold, I'm tired. Go, all right, Mum. She'd start to look after my feelings as well in that way. So the experiment worked really well. Yes.
It's interesting, that example that you give of how we talk to each other. I mean, it's how parents talk to children, but also how partners talk to one another. You use the term fact tennis. What do you mean by that?
A fact tennis. So suppose your husband wants to go to his parents for Christmas and you want to go to your parents for Christmas. And he goes, well, let's go to my parents because it's nearer. And you go, no, let's go to my parents because the spare bedroom is bigger there. And he goes, no, let's go to my parents because the kids can play in the park there or something. And you go on until you've run out of facts. And then you might win the argument, but at the expense of the other person, and you haven't really learned any more about it. But if he says, I really miss my mum and I want to see her, and you say, I really miss my dad and I really want to see him, and then you work out who's going to miss which parent the most, and then you can come to some sort of compromise, like it's obvious we have to see both sets of parents, even though they're 400 miles apart.
So rather than there being an argument that there's a winner on some logical, objective basis,
yes,
it's what do we feel, whether it's right or wrong or good or bad, it's I feel this and you feel this.
The thing is, that's what we're arguing for anyway. It's a bit like, you see that we didn't argue Brexit on facts. And the left were so confused. They get saying, but we'll be so much worse off if we leave. And the others were going, we don't care. So there was no arguing. But had they actually gone into the feelings and found out that half the country felt left out and marginalised and wanted to punish the other half, we might have come to a better compromise in the end. So it is in families. Find out what's everybody's feeling. See who can stand the most, see who can stand the least. Cooperate and compromise rather than conflict and conquering.
Does this kind of parenting ask a lot more of us? Does it ask us to be much more self-aware than maybe we tend to be?
Possibly a little bit more self-aware. But actually, once you get the hang of it, it's a lot easier. It's a lot easier not having battles. It's a lot easier when you aren't pitting your will against each other. This came to me, this is what happens in families, in a flash once, at a moment, like, I'd stopped down, because I was walking home with my daughter, and she'd stopped to look at some ants, and I had a moment, flash of annoyance in me, thinking, oh, God, I wanted to get home. Then I thought, actually, she's just been overstimulated. She probably needs some quiet time. We'll go with what she's doing. So we stopped to look at the ants together. And I think all this was witnessed by an old man who was shuffling up the road. And he said to me when he got to me, he's very friendly, very nice old man. He said, "You're letting her win then? She winning. Got a rod for your own back there, haven't you, love?" And I thought, actually, it's not a competition. It's not a win-lose thing. I didn't say that to him, of course. That would have been a very, very snarky thing to say. I just went, but I just thought, well, isn't that interesting? I mean, sometimes, of course, when she stops to look at ants and I've got an electrician to come and fix something coming to the house in 5 minutes, I'd go, "You want to look at the ants, but we're going to carry on. I'm sorry."
That dynamic can be challenging when there's two sets of wants or two sets of needs, when it's just one parent and one child. But if there's more than one child, or there's a child with special needs, you know, I imagine this can get trickier with the more people who are in that stew.
I think if we've got a bit of conflict going on about, you know, A wants to go to this part, but B wants to go to that shop, I think what we have to do is the old feelings thing. We have to slow everything right down. So say we've got a couple of siblings in conflict, sort of A wants to go to the park, B wants to go to the shop, and I'm saying you have to stay together. So how are you going to solve this? You know, and you just teach them how to brainstorm and teach them how to respect their feelings and respect everybody else's feelings. People say, doesn't that take time? I go, yes, it does take time the first three or four times you do it, and then it saves you time for the rest of your life.
Was there ever a time that you can remember, Philippa, where despite all of your self-awareness and your best intentions, that you just dropped your bundle and lost it and actually really failed against your own standards?
Yes, terrible, absolutely terrible. I remember once when my daughter was, she was very slow on the old potty training for number two, but I thought, you know, you're four, it's about time you got this right. Okay, so I used to watch her face, and just about when she was just about to poo, she'd do a poo face, and I'm gonna do it for you now. That poo face, have a look in the mirror next time you're about to poo, you'll see the poo face. It's brilliant. And so when I just go poo, pick her up and put her on the potty, right? And she was playing with her Lego one day, and she covered her face with her hands like that. And then I smelled a most god-awful smell. And I went, she knew she was about to poo, and she covered her face so she could carry on playing with the Lego. I was furious. I said, you knew you were about to poo, and you didn't. Oh, how could you? And now, I lost it. I was training as a psychotherapist at this point, and we've been told that, you know, the most traumatic thing for a child, one of the most traumatic things of the child, is that they're shamed because they haven't got control of their bladder and bowels, and, you know, it can lead to a lot of damage with the child. So just imagine how remorseful I felt. But on the upside, never seemed to have any accidents after that.
And she's turned out okay.
She's turned out okay. She hasn't really got any poo fixations or anything, so it's all great.
Or if she does, she's talking about them with her own psychotherapist and not with you, and that's probably healthy too.
She hasn't gone to psychotherapy. I said, surely you've got something you need to, you know, work through, like that incident. And apparently not. What else did I do that was appalling? Oh, God. Oh. She was about 9 years old, and we were on a walk in the country. We were staying in a little country cottage, and she said she was going back by herself. And when we got home, she was there. She said, a cow knocked me over. And I said, cows don't do that. I think what you're saying is that you were scared on the way home on your own. She said, no, I wasn't, and a cow knocked me over. I went, I didn't believe her, because I was brought up in the countryside. If I know anything, it's cows. And they're right old scaredy cats. You can clap your hands and wave your arms and then run away, right? Anyway, I was back there again a few years later. I was with my daughter. My shoelace came undone. So I crouched down to do my shoelace up. A cow came over, knocked me over. I went, oh, when you're smaller than the cow, they think you're fair game. When you're taller than the cow, They're not very good at physics, and they can't work out they've got a million times the bulk of you have. They don't knock you over. I said, they really did knock you over that time, didn't they? And she went, yes. And I went, I am so sorry that I didn't believe you. It was because I was often not believed as a child. So I told lies so that my parents would believe me, because they believed the lies but not the truth. And so I was getting confused with you and me, and you never tell lies. She says, I do, actually, but that wasn't one of them. So that was resolved. But I wasn't pleased, looking back on it, that I'd confused her at nine with me at nine, me quite capable of telling a lie at nine, her less so.
A child at four needing to learn how to use the potty to do a poo, or a child at nine encountering dangerous cows in fields. Yes. They're kind of a different order, it feels, than the teenager.
Those are great. How old is she? 14? I want to go to Amelia's to do my homework. Yeah, okay, off you go. This was the time when mobile phones, they weren't smartphones, but they were mobile phones. And I just wanted to check something, so I rang her up about something. That does not sound like a homework situation. That sounds like a bar situation. So I said, are you in a bar? She said, no, Mum, no, no. I said, I'm just going to ring you on Amelia's landline. She said, oh, don't you believe me? Don't you trust me? I went, right now, no, not really. Anyway, I didn't ring up Amelia's landline, and Amelia's mum thought, I thought Amelia was doing homework at your house. I went, oh, this is amusing, isn't it? We've got a situation here. And anyway, when she did come back, I said, so what do you think the consequences should be of you lying and saying that you were doing homework when, in fact, you were obviously in a bar? By the way, which bar was it? She said, it wasn't a proper bar, Mum. It was the university. Anyway, I said, what do you think the consequence should be of that? She said, maybe grounded for 2 weeks. I went, no, 1 week. Come on. Can't have you around here all the time. I said, the thing is about you being in a bar is that I'm scared that you'll want to impress people much older than yourself and do things that aren't safe for you. And she said, that's you being scared. I went, that's correct. That's me being scared. She said, don't you trust me to be responsible in that situation? And I went, you're going to have to give me some time for that, because I'm not there yet. So this is another thing I would say is, like, when you're saying to your child, no, you can't go on the night bus by yourself, tell them that you're not ready to let them do that. Don't define them, define yourself. They find that a lot easier to hear. Anyway, of course, a couple of years later, she was 16 and she wanted to go to a music festival. And it was terrifying for me to let her go to a music festival, but I reckoned it was time I faced my fears, and she was quite responsible. So I let her go to a music festival, and she was fine, and she came back and she'd had a good time. It was great. But I said, where's the tent? She went, ah, someone set fire to it. I went, oh, my God. It is scary having a teenager. I'm not pretending it's not. It is scary. But define yourself and not the child. So if you are too scared to let the child out at night, or whatever it is you're scared about, say that's why they can't go. Don't say you are far too young, because that's so annoying when someone defines you, isn't it? Don't be doubly annoying.
And ideally, I guess, you've built up this communication and trust where their feelings are taken into account, and the listening that were using and employing with her from a little age, hopefully that flourishes in that adolescent period.
It is great, because they can tell you when their tent caught fire if they know that you are accepting of things like that, you know? Yeah. And I really relish the relationship I have with my 28-year-old daughter now. It's fantastic. Really like it.
Grayson has a ceramic artwork called It's Never Too Late to Have a Happy Childhood. Do you think that's true?
I think whatever happened to you in childhood happened, and I think childhoods can actually be stolen. I think if you are in a very serious abuse situation, you know, if you're sexually or emotionally abused, I think those scars remain. However, you can always play, you can always create, you can always find the part of you that does want to grow and develop. And it's never too late to kickstart that.
Philippa, thank you so much for sharing your story on Conversations.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.